Hello and welcome to the Columbus Metropolitan Club on WCBE. Learn more about CMC's weekly events, broadcast, membership, and sponsorship at our website, columbusmetroclub.org, where you can register to attend in person or participate in the live stream of our weekly Wednesday noon forums. Today's forum, Police, to Serve and Protect, was recorded in front of a live audience on June 2, 2021. Speaking are President and CEO of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower, General Counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police, Larry James, Attorney General of the State of Ohio, Dave Yost, and our host, lifelong journalist, Jerry Revish. Let's listen in.
I'm so glad to be a part of this panel discussion today and see my friends that I've known down through the years. Law enforcement is one of the most difficult and stressful occupations in America. Police officers are often called upon to make split-second decisions in very dangerous situations. How these encounters are handled can mean the difference between someone losing their life or keeping it, including police officers. The issue is too complex for this limited time we have to explore it today, but hopefully our panelists will help us get to some of that common ground that Joelle spoke of. I'd like to start by asking about perceptions. Perceptions of law enforcement. Protect and serve. What's the perception of the role of police in the community? Let's start with Stephanie Hightower.
Well, that's not fair, Jerry, but thank you. Thank you for CMC for this very important conversation. And just so you know, I probably at your places too. So Larry gave me a memo about qualified immunity. So since I have to sit between two lawyers up here today, I want to apply that to my comments, if I can, because I think it's important that I get some grace sitting between these two legal minds. Anyway, perception. So as a community person, when the black community and the brown community, when we look at the perception, or when we talk about perceptions to protect and serve, in our community, we say that police come to protect us. I mean, they do not come to protect us. They come to police black and brown communities. But in the majority community, they are there to protect and serve. And so there is the perception that police are not there to protect us. They are here to police us. And some kind of way we have got to change that perception in the community, especially in the black and brown communities, that when you see a police officer, they are not there to harm you.
Thank you. Larry James, you're the general counsel for the National FOP. I'm curious to find out what you heard in your conversations with officers and unions about how they are perceived in the community.
Thank you, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of the National FOP. You have two memos before, and I thought I'd take this opportunity to put them out. The first is qualified immunity, but the more important one, I think, is the one on total number of law enforcement. And I just want to give you a little factual history. In the United States, we have over 800,000 law enforcement officers. In each year, they make over 10 million plus arrests a year. So the perception from the black community and many of our friends is that when they're driving and they're stopped by the police, they get intense. They seem to be worried. That's the narrative we hear over and over again. And particularly the black mothers have to have this talks with their sons and sometimes their daughters as well as to this apprehension and narrative that seems to be there too often. On the police side, the gentleman here today is Jason Pappas, Columbus police officer. I appointed Jason when I was safety director. So from their side of it, here's the narrative I hear. Larry, I've been serving as a police officer for 30 plus years. I have served in the zip codes of predominantly black communities, almost without exception. I haven't had a racial encounter. I haven't had an abuse. I haven't had anything. But wherever I go when I'm seen in that uniform, I am the villain. I don't understand it, and it's hurtful, it's painful. How do we get here?
Dave Yost is our state attorney general, and from your viewpoint on perception of police officers, what are you hearing?
Well, both of my colleagues have accurately described what I hear. The fact of the matter is it does depend, your perceptions depend on who you are and where you live. But here is my conclusion. There is still overwhelming support for the job that police officers do, the function that they play in a civilized society to maintain order. And the question we're really asking, and it's a useful to debate kind of thing, how are we going to accomplish that? Where I think it's unhelpful is when we start talking about deconstructing the entire profession, when we pretend that laws enforce themselves all by themselves, when we begin to paint everybody with one brush. Think about this for a second. We have doctors who are incompetent, who make sick people worse, who fail to heal injured people. Sometimes docs who use their privilege to commit horrific acts. We've heard of, you know, a few docs here and there who have sexually assaulted somebody while they're under anesthesia. Do we turn around and say all docs are butchers or all docs are predators? Of course not. What we do is we hold those people accountable. We look at how the process works and what the level of accountability is, try to make sure that people are answerable for their actions. But the wholesale condemnation in some quarters of our society of law enforcement is deconstructing our society, and we need to draw back and have the conversation about how are we going to have law enforcement rather than the character and nature of the people that are doing that necessary public function for us.
I think you'd all three agree, maybe you don't, let me know, that there needs to be some reform. Police work needs reform. Stephanie, what would that look like for you? What would reforming police work look like for you?
First, thank you for that. I want to just comment on one of, Dave, your comments about maintaining order. And I think that's part of what that perception and that negative perception is. You just said it. They're here to maintain order. What that implies to me is that when you come into the black community, there's disorder. And it's not. Yes, there is, as we know now in this community, crime is happening from Main Street all the way out to Polaris. Shootings are occurring everywhere. So I think there, again, that perception about maintaining order, again, what I heard you say was that there is not order when you come into the black community. And I think that's what the perception is in the black community. I think what we're looking at, and when you look at the George Floyd Justice Act that we're trying to get passed in Washington, what accountability is what reform needs to look like. And Dave, you did mention about holding police accountable, but when you have right now a union contract that has a stranglehold on our community, it's really hard to really hold people accountable. You know, I don't understand how we have a police officer, Columbus police officer, who's still sitting is in his seat after numerous complaints of racist behavior is going on, but the union was able to do whatever they do to, for him to maintain his job. This is someone who has intimidated black people, who uses the N-word, and then we ended up having to settle. The city council had to then settle with the black police officer who had been discriminated against for, what, $400,000, but this man still sitting in his seat at Columbus Police Department as a sergeant. So that accountability piece, I think, is really important. And, you know, I think there should be a registry for those officers who have been involved in misconduct type behavior. We know in this country right now that, you know, you can be a Columbus police officer and then something happens, you get fired, and then you can go right out here to Dublin or you can go out here to Delaware County, and it's like your record has been expunged and like nothing has ever happened. So I think those are two things that, you know, we have to take a look at when we're talking about reform. I agree. We have, Dave, we have a lot of wonderful police officers, or Larry, what you just described. I am not painting them with a broad brush. But when you see what happened in Tulsa, and I'm sure many of you watched what happened, and not one person, number one, the police officers ended up being a part of the rioting that went on. The police officers were part of that, giving guns to those community members. And then you walk away, and there was nobody who was held accountable for those 300 lives. And basically the dissemination of a black wealthy community in Oklahoma. So when black people see all of these things happening and there's no accountability, then that's why the perception is what it is today around policing. There's too many instances out there of negative things regarding black people being shot and killed by police officers. That unfortunately that becomes the perception, and we know that there are great officers. I have some friends that are great police officers, but unfortunately everybody does get painted with that broad brush, and I don't know how we fix it.
Attorney General Yost, you and the governor have put forth a law enforcement oversight and accountability board. Where is that now? Is it moving through the legislature, or what's up with that?
Well, Representative Plummer was just asked that this very morning at a press conference I was at, and he's waiting on some revisions that his co-sponsor has asked for to come back from drafting. But I have high hopes that we will see that soon. We've been working diligently, my office, with stakeholders in the legislature for well over a year. And I want to answer your question, but I want to just bounce back to something Stephanie said. It's not that the black community is disorderly, not at all. It's that human beings are disorderly. Human beings tend to be out of order as individuals from time to time. White community, black community, it's in the nature of human being. I could go physics on you and say entropy increases, and that's just as true in human affairs as it is in physics. But look, the people that I've talked to that live in disadvantaged communities or who live in a black community or brown community, they want order maintained too. What we're talking about is how does that order be maintained. They want their kids to be safe, to go to the store, go to school. And that is not in any way distinguishing between segments of the community. Now, with regards to reform, Stephanie and I are exactly on the same page on this. You need to be held accountable when you act badly. Now, I'm not going to get in. I'll let Larry speak to the point about the union contracts. But law enforcement, one of the most important professions we have, a profession that we give people a gun and handcuffs and say, go out and keep the order, and if you have to use deadly force to protect life, you're allowed to. Wow, what a responsibility. And they don't have any licensing. People don't realize this. There is no license to be a law enforcement officer. You have to be a prosecutor. You have to be to be a lawyer. You have to be to practice accountancy or medicine or plumbing and electricians. We even license the people at the nursing homes that change the bedpans. But we don't license law enforcement. So the accountability question comes down to this dichotomy. Can you get proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict of a criminal offense or whatever you can glom out of the grievance process. And I see former Mayor Greg Lashutka's here. I think he knows a little bit about how hard it is within the CBA in Columbus to hold officers accountable. We need licensing. It needs to be a state law, and we need it sooner rather than later.
Reforming police work. Larry James, in light of the constraints of the contract that the police department has with the city, how can reform happen, and what would it look like for you?
Well, you know, we were sitting before, and Jerry asked me the question, how in God's name could the situation happen in L.A. years ago with Rodney King? And I said, since that time, we've seen an increase in officers being indicted, officers being convicted, officers going to jail, officers being accountable. We have seen a push for law enforcement officers to be mandated on intervention, how that all goes. So the thing, having worn both hats as safety director responsible for hiring, firing, training, the union does not hire, the union does not fire, the union does not discipline, the union does not set the rules. The union negotiates with the administration about the contract, and when that administration decides that it doesn't have the financial wherewithal and it wants to parse out some of management rights, that's what we deal with. If you ask me as a lawyer and I'm representing the client, you're not going to ask me to compromise my integrity and my fiduciary responsibility of representing that individual. That is the American due process way. If there's a failure on the part of accountability, I would strongly suggest it's on the part of the administration. Cops don't want to be with bad cops. Jason will tell you that. The people in the leadership of the FOP will tell you that. When I was safety director and Larry Deck was president of the union, he'd come to me and he'd say, you know, director, you're right, this guy, this gal ain't so good. But what they wanted to do is find consistency of integrity and enforcement. Because the first three cases that came to me for termination as safety director were three black officers. And it just wasn't there. And I told them, I said, I am not going to lessen that standard. We're going to get everyone the right way. We're going to give them their due process. And if we have to hound them night and day, we do that. But that's management's responsibility. Don't put that on the union.
In the wake of the police shooting of 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant a few weeks ago by a Columbus police officer, Stephanie, you said police see people of color differently, and they need to look at black children differently. Can you expand on that for us?
Sure. And I know this is a really sensitive, this one is really sensitive. There is a term now that I have become very familiar with called the adulteration of black children. And unfortunately, what that means is that in the majority community, a lot of our young people who are 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age are seen as adults, and they're treated as adults. And in the case of Micaiah, she was a 16-year-old baby. Was she in an awkward position when the police officer arrived? Absolutely. I've gotten a lot of negative feedback from my comments about Micaiah, so I am going to try to make sure that I don't ruffle any feathers today with this. But I will say this. When the police officer rolled up, you're absolutely right. He did not ask how old was she, right? He saw in his mind a woman standing there about to attack another woman. But I think the other part of this is I continue to hear in the media, and I did send out a release to the media. Yet just yesterday, the reporter was talking about Micaiah was about to lunge at another woman. She wasn't a woman, she was a child. And I think that's part of what happens when police officers come into the black community, even with our black boys. They are seen as adults. In their mind and their thinking, these are not adults. These are children. These are babies. In some kind of way, through this process, Dave, that we were talking about when we're retraining, we have to start looking at our community, the black community, differently. I think that the majority community, they don't look at our children as children, and that's been shown over time. Our children have been traumatized in the black community for years. When they see a black man being murdered, George Floyd on TV, this is trauma. And no one wants to talk about that trauma with black children, because then what it does, it then manifests itself into other things. And so we have to stop adulterating our black girls and boys. We need to look at them as children in every single way. I don't care if they're 5 or they're 15. And I do believe that based upon the situations, when you look in the black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods, I still beg the question, if that situation had been in a white neighborhood, would the response have been the same for a 16-year-old white female as opposed to a 16-year-old black female? I just asked the question. And I just need all of us, you know, as we talk about these things, we have to be willing to have honest conversation about how perceptions matter, and that there are so many misperceptions about our black children in the white communities. And you see that every day, the way they're treated in their in schools. So we have to start having those kind of conversations that are going to be helpful to get rid of the misperceptions about black children and what happened to Micaiah.
Jerry, I want to follow up. One of the things I think we can do, because when you look at the statistics over 10 million arrests a year and where they manifest itself and whether there's a police shooting, if we were to audit all those situations that we think something went wrong and we took those back into the academy, or we statistically put those together and we ask ourselves, what could we, what should we have done differently? How can we improve the policing of these encounters? That's what we haven't done. And we, at least at the national level, have been trying to push that. We have our biennial meeting this year in August in Indianapolis. That is one of the things on the agenda. So what I've tried to do as GC, as you can see from this paper, as you look at it, is how do we look at those situations, quantify them, analyze them, and determine how we can improve, whether that's the training. And I'll give you one situation. We have a case pending that went before the Supreme Court, and I just digress a bit. But you had a federal task force with a local jurisdiction, and they were looking for a 26-year-old white male. They ended up running into a 21-year-old white male. They went to arrest him. They start to frisk him. They take his wallet. He turns around. He fights. And it goes worse from there. Now, they didn't identify themselves as police officers undercover. So I think we can take all these situations and we can quantify them and we can say, officer, there's a better way to do it. I don't know if the Stephanie situation, she went over, you know, what we do in that situation, because it's an awful tragedy. But I think we have to look at, evaluate, and improve on those.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club Forum, Police to Serve and Protect, recorded in front of a live audience on June 2, 2021. Speaking are President and CEO of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower, General Counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police, Larry James, Attorney General of the State of Ohio, Dave Yost, and our host, lifelong journalist, Jerry Revish. On WCBE 90.5 FM Columbus, 106.3 FM Newark, streaming online at WCBE.org, a broadcast service of Columbus City Schools. We'll return to the conversation after a short break.
Here's some of the latest content in WCBE's podcast experience. Double Take reviews the films Together, Together, and Shiva or Shiva. John and Johnny will debate that. Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future explores how creative skills can be learned and developed. And if Ohio has some of the world's preeminent healthcare institutions, why does the state rank among the worst in the nation in health outcomes? Listen to Prognosis Ohio. Find those shows and more in WCBE's podcast experience at wcbe.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club. You're listening to Police, to Serve and Protect. Let's get back to the conversation.
So, Attorney General Yost, what help could your office provide in bringing more clarity, more understanding to these perceptions of bias by police?
Well, that's a fair question, and we're working through that, and it's actually a large raft of questions underneath that that general question. I want to just briefly point out how dangerous it is for any of us to impute motives. Now, this has become very hip in our political culture. We all know what everybody else thinks and why they think it and what's really going on in their heart, at least if you read Twitter. But the fact of the matter is, very rarely do we know what other people are thinking, and groups of people are still individuals. They think different things for different reasons. They bring their own lived experiences to it. So I think that it's I think we need to be very cautious about saying how the community views police. And I think we have to be very careful about imputing motives to individual police officers. I don't think anybody can speak for all police officers in terms of what they think, how they view children, how they view situations. But let me say this, while I totally agree, and would not want to be held accountable for all the things that I did when I was a teenager, and teenagers are children, there comes a point where the diminution of responsibility attenuates. Because somebody who has been killed and is dead on the ground because of a 15-year-old is just as dead as if they were killed by a 25-year-old. Now, to answer your question, thank you for letting me respond to my two colleagues. One of the things that I've asked my staff to do, and we're working with some academics and trying to really think about this. You've all seen in movies or on the news, the simulators that police use to train. And they're very useful in making those training decisions that have to be made, as you said, Jerry, within a split second. But most of America has something that's called shoot, don't shoot training. And you're given a binary choice when you go into that situation. You have to determine the good guys and the bad guys and make a quick decision, get right. And if you make the wrong decision, either an innocent person is dead or you're dead. That's not the way the real world operates out there. That's the way a piece of it operates. But an officer has a lot more things on their utility belt than just a gun. They have a taser. They have a baton. They have other options. They have their voice. They have, most important, their mind. And so what I've challenged my team to do is let's find a vendor for this software that is going to use everything on the tool belt so that the decision matrix isn't binary. It's not shoot, don't shoot. It's not threat, not threat. It's how do I deal with this situation? What is my best option at this particular moment? Good cops that have been on the job for 20 years get this by being on the job. But we need to make that more robust and more widespread. The Attorney General's office is working on it. I hope to be there long enough to see it come to fruition.
But Jerry, if I could, I want to go back to what Dave you mentioned about how police officers bring their lived experiences to the table. And I think that, you know, you and I were talking a little bit about that earlier. When your lived experience is that you grew up in a racist household, if your lived experience is that you've only grown up with other white people, if your lived experience is you, what you watch on TV is how you perceive black people, unfortunately, you're going to bring that to the job. And yes, it's not intentional. I know we can't speak to people's motives, but when you don't live in the community that you serve, or if you don't take the time to understand the culture in the community you serve, you bring your white culture and your white lived experience into a black community that is not of the same culture, and then you try to impose your white values on the black community. And I think those are the kinds of conversations we need to have. I remember when, you know, me and my second husband went to Africa, and we were in the bush in Africa, right? And so one of the things that we had to be mindful of is that even as black Americans, our lived experience was different from those Africans in the bush. And so meaning that I can't imply or I can't expect them to do certain things to, from a cultural standpoint, that me as an African American should have expectations for. Too much in this community, in this country, you're bringing your values into our community and expecting those to fly. And that's not how the real world works. Policing needs to look more at what are the values of the black community. And that's why I think it's important that from a recruitment standpoint, there needs to be more officers that look like the people in the community that they serve, because they're going to bring some of those lived experiences with them so that maybe we can diffuse and have better reconciliation when we come into the black community. But lived experiences matter.
They do, and I hope that I can count on the Urban League to help us recruit minority officers across Ohio.
You will see in the paper right now, with over 800,000 officers nationally, we're looking at about 12% black officers. At our spring board meeting, I said to our trustees and our executive committee, pay particular attention to your black officers out there, because they're catching more hell than anyone. They are the Uncle Toms. They are the sellouts. They are the field folks, in strong words, to follow. So on the one hand, we say we want to recruit diversity. And on the other hand, if you were to talk to the black officers that were part of the situation in Columbus and the riots, they got called every name you could think of. And if cops are the villains, we've seen 30% early retirement. We've seen our recruitment go down. We've seen the quality of soliciting individuals go down just to fill the bodies. We've got to figure out what we want and how we want it and whether we're going to be objective in this criteria. And I'll give you an example. I was out in a city, and we were trying to get the FOP recognized. And a lady who reminded me of Barbara Jordan, she said, so, Mr. J, you know, my FOP folks had left the room. And, you know, I said, you know, we're going to have that conversation with only black folks. And what they said to me is, Mr. James, I don't want to be offensive to you, but are you an Uncle Tom? Are you that good? I said, no offense taken. I'm that good. And you've got to be comfortable with that. What I see in the public arena, that someone's going to get offended because someone did a no-confidence vote, or they took out a billboard, or they called you a name, seriously? Leadership is going to have to mature, grow up, go into the room, deal with all the controversy, and lead and give us a better society in every aspect.
We're going to be moving to questions from our in-person and live stream audience in a few moments, but I'd like to ask one final question of all three of you. Columbus has a new police chief. The announcement is going to come today. 48-year-old Elaine Bryant, the assistant Detroit police chief. Historic, first chief chosen from outside the division, and first black woman to hold the job. What would be one piece of advice you would give this incoming police chief to improve the Columbus Police Department. Stephanie?
Well, I would love to have the conversation with her about joining me to talk about reconciliation in our community around policing. At the Columbus Urban League, we've been talking about the three R's for the last year, recovery, reform, and resiliency, and we've now added the last one, which is reconciliation. And we've got to have conversations in our community. We have to have real talk, and I'm willing to help her and the Columbus Police really talk about and have those conversations about reconciliation, because I think that is where then we can start to begin to make a difference.
Dave, you also asked the same question of you and maybe massage it a little bit, just to improve the perception, the way the police department is perceived in the city and how it goes about its job to improve that work. What would you tell her?
The new police chief's number one job for the next year is not controlling costs, coming up with new strategies, none of the things that you traditionally think of as police work. You've got great trained people that know how to do all that stuff. The new chief of police needs to build trust. And it needs to build more than just trust with the community. There's a breakdown in some parts of our community between the people that are served and those who serve. But in addition, there is a breakdown of trust between management and the rank and file officers. And I talk with them regularly. And that has to be rebuilt. They have to believe that they've got a chief who has their back and understands their job. And the new chief has to build trust with City Hall, because right now that relationship is not going to thrive. And without the trust of City Hall, without the trust of the troops, without the trust of the community, Superman, Jesus Christ, Wonder Woman, all of them would fail. Trust building, and it's just like any other relationship, Jerry, it takes repeated efforts in the same direction in order to get there.
Larry, you get the last word.
I would advise her or recommend that she takes her iPad and she goes to every corner of this community. She has her executive staff to accompany her. I would take copious notes. I would get to know those leaderships in those communities, learning the problems. As Attorney General Yost said, I think the same thing you have to do with your rank and file. Buck Reinhart, who was a mayor who I served under when I came in as safety director, he said, take your notebook and pad, go out to each of the substations, meet with them on each one of their shifts, go to the community, meet with each one of them. Then I want you to meet with each CEO and or business leaders in your first 90 days. And I want you to then compile it, and I want you to revisit that every so often just to show your accountability. I mean, I think that idea is learning on the job, and it's a hell of a job, and I think you're right, because one of the things that I could rely on when I was safety director, I really bypassed the chief, I bypassed the deputy chiefs, and I went to my command staff, and those guys and gals were the foots on the street, and they kept my butt out of trouble, and they told me what was going on, and I had their back.
Thank you, all three. You know, it's CMC's tradition to take audience questions, and Jane Scott of the Columbus Metropolitan Club is curating questions from the live stream audience and from our live audience. So please keep your questions brief and to the point. And Jane, what is our first question?
I'm chuckling because some of these questions are taking up the whole screen. I will ask questions from those that have been submitted and those that we've gone online, but everyone in the room, please feel free to line up behind me and we'll trade off every other one. So I'm going to start, it's kind of a continuation of what you all have been talking about. This is from Elizabeth King from the League of Women Voters. Can police unions be brought in as partners to bring change to policing structure and mentality? And how can we accomplish this?
Absolutely. I think they are a partner. Look, as I said, Jason Pappas sits here 30-plus years. They're going to be here when the elected officials are gone. Those are the people that have to live with and sometimes die with the decisions are made. So I think the idea of when we negotiated contracts, we sat down, they are into improving equipment. They are improving practice and training. So absolutely. And if you don't do that, you're going to get a less than best product.
Thank you. State your name and your question.
Mimi Dane. Should the reading of the new Jim Crow be a mandatory part of police training in an effort to reduce the militarization of the police?
You know, Mimi, I would say, you know, there are a lot of readings. There are a lot of great books that I think and trainings that need to be incorporated in seminars into police training around cultural sensitivity. I will say I believe that what is being used right now, like those kinds of publications, we talked about My Grandmother's Hands, there are books that would help, I think, our police officers better understand, but I'm not sure that those are the kinds of trainings that are being given to our police officers to help them to be better at it. I think those are simulations. When I look at some of them, are a joke, because in the real world, the way people respond to police officers is not how those simulations are put together. And I think there has to be a different kind of training that is real world training to help our police officers.
Thanks.
There are a couple questions that are along the same themes. Steve Swift, how many complaints are filed by officers on other fellow officers in the CPD on an annual basis? And how are cops holding each other accountable?
Could you repeat the question, Jane?
How many complaints are filed by officers on other fellow officers in the CPD on an annual basis? And the correlate that to another person, how are cops holding each other accountable?
I'm not sure. This panel does not have that information, but I can give you one example. As safety director, we had one officer who would use mace as regular as saying hello. And I remember calling the command staff in and trying to understand that. And they said that was not a definition as a use of force. And so we classified it as a use of force. I think most police departments are trying to revisit those issues and what triggers an officer to go back into in-service training, whether he or she has had too many encounters or too many complaints, or it's just time. I think one of the things that is sadly missed is to have those officers go into repeated in-service training on a regular basis. If you're out there and dealing with all the stuff officers deal with, the emotional toll it takes, it needs help.
Carol Looper, another veteran journalist here in our city.
Well, lifelong reporter is a good thing to be called, Jerry. There is a word that none of you have used that has been coming up in the news a lot, and that's defund the police departments. There are a lot of different takes on that. Would you respond to how you feel when you see or hear the term defund the police?
Thank you. I would love to. Why do we have government in the first place? I mean, this stuff is really expensive. It's big. It doesn't work real well some of the times. And it's always frustrating. Why do we have government? Because that's when you're talking about police. That's Columbus, that's the biggest part of the budget is police, or public safety at any rate. And it's because prior to civilized society, the guy with the biggest club killed you, took your stuff, and sold your family into slavery. And we all got together and realized that if we collectively provide for public order and public safety, that we could begin to thrive. We would have a future to build for. We would have a hope of having property that we could hold on to and give it to our children, that we could live free and unafraid. That's where government comes from, and the first and most important function of government is public safety. Now, I know that I've heard some people say, well, that's just a hashtag. What we really mean is we want to divert funding from police to other ways of maintaining public order. And to those people, I would say, sorry, defund has a definition. It means stop funding that. I appreciate Columbus's good news story here. Columbus has a combination unit of sworn officers and social mental health workers that respond to particular kinds of calls. I've met with those staff, both the sworn and unsworn people. Other officers are starting to support this. They're calling in these special units. That's great. If that's what we're talking about, then yes, let's innovate on police work. Let's be multidisciplinary. But taking away money from the foundation of government is going to have very predictable and horrible results.
Defunding police. Stephanie, how say you?
I agree to a certain extent with Dave on this one. I am not a proponent of defunding. I think it's about how do we innovate? How do we really look at what really community policing is about? And what do we need to add to it? What are those things that Columbus has added to help those police officers? So I'm not a proponent of defunding. Or defunding to me is innovating it. How do we innovate?
Larry?
I think enough has been said on that subject.
Just want to make sure you had an opportunity to respond. Go ahead.
Quite a number of questions that basically get at the idea of new and improved training for officers, everything from mental health to social issues to, as you mentioned, Dave, about the choices between shoot and no shoot, things like that. Who's in charge? Who's going to rewrite this curriculum, and who's going to pay for it, and how is it going to be implemented?
Well, the most important question you asked is who's going to pay for it. Who's in charge? Currently, the Ohio Police Officer Training Academy, which is part of the Attorney General's office, has that primary mission. But guess what, folks? 737 hours to get your basic academy certification that you've done the minimum, and then you get your badge. And from then on, the only state-required training that you have is sporadic if it's funded. And not surprisingly, it generally doesn't get funded. And in fact, we haven't had, I think it's 4 or 5 years since the last time we got a little smidgen of it. Imagine being an athlete and being out there, and police work is physical work sometimes. Imagine being out there and you never practice. You don't have any drills, you got no coach, you're just going out and playing street ball every day. How long is it gonna take for your skills to degrade? You talk about better police training, how about some police training? I appreciate the fact that we've got academies in our biggest cities that do their own homegrown academies and their own homegrown training, but we need statewide standards. We need to pay for it. Kentucky does it. We don't. Let's get that fixed.
Yeah, and I would add to that, you know, you have all of this money that's coming down from the feds. In Ohio, we have, what, $23 billion in one pot, $11 billion from the Treasury. You know, this is an opportunity, I think, where the governor and you, Dave, can look at what is in those pots of money. And if we're talking about diversity and inclusion and racial equity, I mean, here's an opportunity to use that money to do a lot of the things that you're talking about. But it has to start somewhere, and there has to be a willingness and a commitment on everyone's part, and as Larry said, leadership, to make sure that our officers have the proper training so that they can do their jobs. So when are we going to make the sacrifice in this state to put money into policing so that we can not only protect our citizens but also protect our officers? You got to go ahead and put the money in there.
Thank you, and thank you. Yes.
And this will be our last question, and it's sort of a lofty question. Russell Marzetti from the College of Engineering at OSU. The purpose of a mission statement is to give an organization purpose and direction. The Columbus Division of Police currently posts a mission statement that does not clearly articulate how it serves the community. Given the chance to reimagine the mission statement, what might be some of the core elements of that mission?
I think I would want to take time to really look at it, look at where the organization is, where it's headed, its needs, its deficiencies. I would want to get input from the community. I think we're at a crossroads now that we really can kind of start over. But this point about training, I will tell you, in addition to the recommendation of the audit, and that would be the audit of the budget and how much of that budget goes to training, because that is the first thing to go and the last thing to come. But, you know, mission statements, I think that's, you know, that would be a good challenge for the new chief.
Well, we thank you all for a lively conversation. We just ran out of time. We could go on and on. It's a very important topic, one I'm sure that the CMC will be revisiting as we go ahead. So we thank God for Stephanie Hightower, Larry James, Dave Yost. The preacher came out of me right there. I do pastor a church. So thank you very much.
That concludes today's show. You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club Forum, Police, to Serve and Protect, recorded in front of a live audience on June 2, 2021. Speaking were President and CEO of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower, General Counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police, Larry James, Attorney General of the State of Ohio, Dave Yost, and our host, lifelong journalist, Jerry Revish. More information about today's speakers, this and other forums, membership in the Columbus Metropolitan Club, and our weekly noon Wednesday events is available on our website at columbusmetroclub.org, where you can register to attend in person or participate in the live stream. The Columbus Metropolitan Club, connecting people and ideas through community conversation. Thanks for listening.